You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot going on, a lot in the news. Something about that's going on in Ireland that I want to tell you about a little later on today. The IMF is also concerned about the future of the world economy. We're going to get into that. Mitt Romney had a previous life at Bain Capital. We all know that. Did you know that he was pushing addictive drugs? I mean, seriously, you know, more addictive than heroin. Yeah, in poor countries. Okay, that. The UN has got a new call for a new social safety net. Maybe they're starting to take seriously the sort of things that, like, you know, Jesus was in favor of. Reverend Bill Keller is on the line with us. He is the founder of LivePrayer.com, an online ministry. LivePrayer.com is the website. And Reverend Keller, welcome back to the program.
Tom, always good to be with you, my friend.
Thank you for joining us. I understand you are suggesting that people in this election, instead of voting for Obama or Romney or, for that matter, Stein or Johnson or, you know, any of the others.
Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, that they write in Jesus.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Back in May, we launched a campaign to get give Christians a legitimate way to vote, because they obviously can't vote for the most pro-baby killing, pro-homosexual, pro-enemy of Israel president in the history of this nation.
Talking about Mitt Romney.
No, I'm talking about Barack Obama.
Well, Mitt Romney was, you know, totally down with abortion being completely legal. He's got a new foreign policy. He wants to bomb more people. Well, I forget what else was in your list, but, you know, any position that you attack Obama on, I can find you a time when Romney had that position.
And you're 100% right. But the reason Christians can't vote for Mitt Romney, forget his politics, is because he's a fifth generation high priest of a cult that worships Satan and leads souls to hell with a false gospel that will become mainstream if elected.
Well,
so
I
really
think it's already
Christians
become mainstream.
Really
the Mormon Church
is a rock and hard spot.
Yeah, the Mormon Church has announced a major outreach, but I'm in their defense. I mean, as much as I'm uncomfortable defending any religion.
Defend them, Tom. Defend them.
No. I mean, the fact of the matter is that there are a lot of decent people who are Mormons, and they're not the spawn of Satan. They're just decent people who were raised in the Mormon Church, and you know, fill in the blanks. I mean, there's no religion that doesn't have crazy beliefs, including yours and mine.
Well, no, not really, because Mitt Romney, I mean, if you want to give your listeners one reason to run from Mitt Romney, if there's one listening that is even thinking about it, how about this one? The fact he believes he's going to die and become the god of his own planet with an unlimited number of women to make spirit babies with. That's what Mitt Romney believes, and you want him to be president? Seriously?
So I don't want him to become president. I mean, that's not the reason I don't want him to become president, but I'm pleased to hear, Bill, that, you know, a guy like you, who historically has been identified as a conservative, or even a far right conservative, that you've become a liberal. You want to vote for Jesus. Jesus was the guy who said we should house the homeless, we should feed the hungry,
absolutely,
we should take care of the poor.
Jesus is also the guy who said, "I'm the way, the truth, the life. Nobody comes to the Father but through me." I'm an evangelist. I'm not in politics.
You're advocating people
helping people spiritually.
But you're talking about the vote here. You're saying that people should write in the name of Jesus. And so
Absolutely. If
you're suggesting that arguably one of the most famous liberals in history, the entire liberal agenda is summed up in Matthew 5, 6, 7, 8 and Matthew 25, basically. And you know this, that if you're advocating that people write in the name of the most famous liberal in history into the ballot, I see that as a, you know, good step on your part. Congratulations for becoming
Absolutely.
More progressive.
And I will also remind your listeners that Jesus also said, "There's no other way but to the Father but through me." That means if you believe in Islam, if you believe in Buddha, if you believe in, you know, Twinkle D and Twinkle Dumb, you're going to die and go to hell. And that's my concern, because Mitt Romney and the Mormon cult leads people to hell through a false gospel.
Well, Obama's a Christian. Why not vote for him?
Because he supports killing babies, that's number one. Because he supports redefining God's definition of marriage, that's number two. And because he disses Israel and in Genesis 12:3.
Wait a minute.
God
when did Obama diss Israel?
God said to Abraham, I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you.
You know, I'm familiar with the verse. When did Obama diss Israel? It seems to me that he's been pretty close to Israel. He's done a lot of things for Israel.
On the surface, but he's also been the most pro-Muslim friendly president we've ever had.
Well, by killing bin Laden and killing all these people with these drone strikes? I mean, I frankly don't agree.
No,
he's
like
killing too many innocent civilians.
Supporting the Muslim Brotherhood's overthrow of Mubarak in Egypt? Let's start there.
Well,
right?
What about Mubarak? Mubarak fell.
I said he supported the Muslim Brotherhood's overthrow of Mubarak in Egypt. You know, you gotta
You don't think Mubarak was Muslim?
Tom, wasn't Mubarak, even though he was a dictator, he was still a guy who kept the peace in that region.
He was a Muslim.
Now look what we've got.
Oh, okay. So Bill, are you suggesting that here in the United States that keeping the peace is more important than having freedom?
Keeping the peace in a region where people rule themselves. Yeah, we don't rule Egypt, and all Obama did.
Well,
with
if it's,
Egypt,
I mean, if it,
Libya,
I'm just curious.
You want to even go to Libya? I know you don't want to go to Libya.
If it's good for Egypt to have an authoritarian dictatorship, why is it not good for the United States?
Because that's not the way this country was founded. But in Egypt, that's the way they've always governed themselves from the pharaohs down, and we have disrupted that. And now look at the price we're paying.
So what?
In Egypt,
what is it that makes
Libya,
Egyptians
that region?
You know, well, yeah, and we were. Right? I'm not sure the "we" that you're talking about. If you're talking about the United States of America that started
in
1787, you know, or 1789, I guess, when the Constitution was ratified. Then, yeah, but, you know, that wasn't just a singular we. I mean, there was this long, like, multi-thousand-year history of dictatorship that preceded the United States. If we could make that transition, if we being, by and large, you know, Europeans who came to this country and took over this continent, you know, robbed, raped, and pillaged a whole bunch of natives to do so.
But
if we can make that
to
transition to democracy, why
difference.
Can't the Egyptians?
We had a clean slate to start from. That's the difference. Egypt,
we had a clean
that's
slate?
Been their
Come
history
on.
For 6,000 years.
We had the blood of millions of people on our hands to start from, Bill.
In terms of what?
In terms of the Native American genocide. In terms of a 300-year African-American Holocaust.
No doubt about any of that. This hasn't been a perfect experiment,
but
it's been the best experiment. But you're talking about now going into countries that have 6,000 years of history in a totally different environment.
But so did we.
When
this country started, Bill,
we had
a 6,000-year history that, by the way, went back to Uruk, you know, went back to Iraq and the Epic of Gilgamesh and all that, Western history. We had a 6,000-year history of dictators and theocrats, whether it was the kings.
With a clean slate to start a new project.
That clean slate was a revolution. That's what just happened in Egypt.
It's been the greatest experiment ever.
That clean slate that you're talking about is the American Revolution, I assume. And now, you know, Obama went over to Egypt.
Go back to 1600, Columbus Day. That's where everybody got off yesterday because Christopher Columbus supposedly founded the United States.
So that was our clean slate?
No,
that
was a clean slate.
That was the beginning.
This country was a clean slate when we got here.
I think that the Taino people and the Arawak people and, well, all the native indigenous people of this continent would want to argue with you about that, Bill.
Well, there's no doubt that this country has got a history.
So my question.
But you can't even compare it to a place like Egypt or Libya or places like that have been governed for 6,000 years in a certain way. And then all of a sudden we're going to come in and bring democracy there. I mean, that was the whole issue. Listen, you and I don't agree on much, but we probably both agree that the whole issue in Iraq was a horrible situation.
Well, yeah, there was no reason to go in there and blow up the country. We killed hundreds of thousands of people. And we displaced 5 million people. That is not something Jesus would do either.
Not good.
Okay, Reverend Bill Keller, liveprayer.com is the website. Bill, thanks for dropping by.
Bless you, Tom.
Good luck
praying
voting
for
Jesus. Yeah, have a good one. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So who would Jesus vote for? It's an interesting question. We'll be right back. Easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. I wonder how Mitt Romney handles the dissonance of that, you know, the internal dissonance of that statement. Hard to say. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Well, what you just said, pass through an eye of a needle. It's possible for a camel to go through that. That's a literal place, you know, like a cave, but somebody has to pull the camel and the other people have to push the camel. But the whole idea is that their viewpoint is not on society or on anybody else. It's on themselves. And so Romney is somebody who has proven by his actions at Bain and all he has said about, you know, going down on social safety nets, Medicare, where, you know, a pregnant teenager can have their baby. You know, that's in Medicare. He wants to abolish that. And, you know, usury, you know, that in the temple of the, you know, money changers, and Jesus, you know, kicks over the tables. That's a template for society to follow. So to vote for Jesus is to throw your vote away. It doesn't matter, you know,
well, no,
if he's against both.
I'm with you on that. And if a lot of, you know, hardcore right wing fundamentalists like Bill vote for Jesus instead of for Romney, I'm not going to be real upset about that. But, you know, I think maybe the larger question, and thank you for your comments, Gary. I think one of the larger questions is, how do we get religious people, Christians, Jews, Muslims, whatever, who share a value system, or for that matter, you know, well, I was going to say for that matter, atheists who share a value system, obviously it's all the same, but I'm guessing probably most atheists are going to be pretty turned off by Mitt Romney's religiosity to begin with, although maybe not. How do we get people to vote their values rather than their party? I mean, it's fairly clear to me that we've got, you know, a really substantial values difference here. So anyhow, Aram in Grapevine, Texas. Hey, Aram, what's up? Aram?
Yes.
You're on the air.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
How are you? Yeah.
I'm well. What did you want to say?
I was wondering, in the Middle East. I was just wanting to share a few comments regarding your earlier guest.
Mm-hmm.
Was talking as if people in the Middle East have some kind of a genetic defect that cannot.
Well, that's what I was trying to. I was trying to ask him if he was trying to make some kind of racist argument, or if he was just saying, you know, people have to have as a culture a certain period of time or something. I couldn't figure out what his argument was.
I mean, this is a defective argument to begin with. You have to look at the history of Middle East in the 20th century. All the colonial powers, and then post-World War II, the powers that put in place dictatorships and kept them in power. You know, I'm talking about my own country where I was born, in Iran. We have had two revolutions, and both of which turned out to be non-democratic because of the forces from the outside. So how many times people need to, you know, cause a revolution just to be defeated by the forces from the outside?
Yeah, excellent.
And in the U.S. has like 500 years of colonial and cultural exchange. You cannot just look at the United States like 220 years ago when it was formed as a government.
Well, and beyond that, I mean, yeah, we went through some considerable growing pains. I mean, we had our revolution in 1776, and then we had a civil war, you know, about 80 years later. It's like, you know, it wasn't an easy thing to become a democracy. And then we still had legal apartheid after the civil war, and women weren't allowed to vote, and on and on and on it goes. So, you know, it didn't happen instantly for us. It's not going to happen instantly for anybody. But to say that any group of people should not be allowed an opportunity to try to make democracy work seems to me crazy. Aram, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate your listening. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to comment on Pastor Bill, or whatever his name is. Is it Keller?
Bill Keller, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I really think that people need to understand that, you know, in talking about Israel, that in Palestine, there were the 40% of the population was Christian before the inception, you know, before the beginning of the State of Israel. Most of those people left, but there still is quite a few Christians, or, you know, they believe that they are Christians. They go back to the very early church. And yet these evangelical Christians don't recognize them, and they prefer the State of Israel over their own brethren. Yeah. And I think people need to be aware of that. and I just wanted to point that out. And I think that it's terrible that you know, we're, you know, as Christians, we're supposed to support the state of Israel without any question and allow them to do whatever they want.
Well, you're not hearing that anywhere in that region. I don't think you're hearing that here or anywhere else, John. Nobody is saying, you know, what. In fact, you're not hearing that certainly in Israel. That's the big issue, is that there's a vibrant debate about these issues in Israel, just not so much in the United States. Ed in Honolulu. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Yeah, talking about clean slate, what about the United States taking over Hawaii, you know, in 1894?
Yeah. Yeah, that was, you know, on behalf of Dole Pineapple, wasn't it?
Yeah, and now, you know, they're trying to pass an Akaku bill, and they don't let it pass or give the Hawaiian people the indigenous rights. You know, that's so sad.
Right. There was legislation to give Hawaiian people indigenous rights, federal or state?
Yeah. No, federal, Akaku bill.
And it got knocked down?
Yeah, it got knocked down plenty of times, you know?
Interesting. So the Cherokee can have indigenous rights, or the Mohawk, or, you know, any of the tribes that are familiar names to all of us, but Polynesian people, Hawaiian people, original Hawaiian people, they do not have any indigenous rights. There are no essentially tribal lands in any of Hawaii.
There's some kind of Hawaiian homeland, but to be recognized as indigenous people, not really.
Yeah. Okay. Ed, thanks a lot for calling from Honolulu. Appreciate the call. 27 minutes past the hour. That's a wrong that should be righted. You know, I mean, among the long list of them. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, it also raises a lot of questions, though. It's like, you know, when we annexed a good chunk of Mexico, about half of Mexico in the Mexican-American War, should those folks have native rights? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So the question, how do we get people who consider themselves religious? I mean, the easy way to put the question would be, how do you get Christians to vote for Obama? But, you know, I'd like to make it a little broader than that. People who consider themselves religious, or people who use religion as an ethical worldview, or people who simply, you know, vote their values. Do we know what Mitt Romney's values are? I mean, they've been all over the map. He's been in favor of and opposed to virtually every, you know, moral position. Plus, he's a billionaire. I mean, he's a guy who's sitting on piles of money. He's like Scrooge McDuck. You know, he's part of the 1/1000th of 1%. And that, you know, and he wants to advance the interests of the rest of the 1/1000th of 1%. And that part just makes me concerned, frankly. Philip, listening to AM 950 in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Philip, what's on your mind?
Yes, sir. You know, I've spent 10 years in the U.S. military in the chaplaincy corps, and have been in the ministry for a long time. And it very much upsets me and a lot of colleagues when we hear this garbage from a lot of these nutcases who are misrepresenting the church. And it's very embarrassing and very disrespectful.
Well, there's church to misrepresent, first of all.
Well,
unless you're talking about the Catholic Church.
Well,
and Bill is not a Catholic.
You know, right. There is, and I don't mean Catholic. I mean, we understand that there's a group of people who are just radical in this situation, but the overwhelming majority of the church are good people who are trying to feed the sick, clothe the naked, and help people.
Do you really think so?
Absolutely.
You know, I look at some of these, the hot new thing in ministry right now is this prosperity ministry, where basically they're preaching, you know, I got mine, and if you get more, you'll get more, and let's all get rich, and nobody's talking about let's start a homeless shelter.
Absolutely. But if you really slow down, I mean, really take a step back and you look, you will see that that's what, a half a dozen pastors on TV and a few pastors in
with
your local
millions
area.
Of followers.
Right. But how many pastors are there throughout the country? They're the ones who get all of the notice.
Right.
They're the ones who get all the notoriety. There are thousands of us, millions all over the world, who don't do anything close to that.
Right.
Look at how many chaplains there are just in the U.S. military.
So how do we get Christians to vote for the guy who is advocating on behalf of the poor, the hungry, and the sick, which would be, in this case, in this presidential case, Mr. Obama?
Believe it or not, I think that a lot more are than you know, otherwise he wouldn't have gotten elected in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. Although I look at these polls and I'm just, it just blows my mind. Philip, I want to get a lot of calls in here on
Absolutely.
This, so I'm going to move along. Thank you very much. Chris, listening to WHMP in Amherst, Mass. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I can answer that question in terms of what you just said with this. How is it that Mitt Romney has not been asked if he believes that the real Bible was found under a rock in Minnesota? I think that would raise a few eyebrows in terms of Christians. And I'm not being
you're talking about Mormons saying that the real Bible was
religiosity, because that's a belief, and if that's their belief, that's a Mormon belief. He should own up to it.
Right. Okay. All right. Chris, this is one of the problems with Mormonism is has been historically. I think they're overcoming it, though, because like in any religion, there's this, who's going to believe that woman with her husband who was pregnant in that stable in December, actually it was in March, apparently, was actually a virgin. I mean, come on. Dan in Chicago. Hey, Dan.
Yeah. Tom?
Yes.
You've heard, I think, the map is not the territory, right?
Yes, sir. It's it's NLP 101.
We could be talking about the same thing, and they call it one thing, we call it something else, and then you have a war over it.
Depends on who the they and the we is, but by and large, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And, so what's your point?
You can convince yourself of it's all words.
Okay. All right. I got it, Dan. I got it. It's all words. Thank you. Corky in Rochester, your thoughts.
I get preacher out there. It says the earth is 9,000 years old. I grew up in Catholic school for 9 years.
Right.
And we were taught science alongside creation.
Right.
We got taught all the way back to the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, the Catholics are pretty good about that. They kind of got burned with that Galileo thing, 500, 600, 800 years ago, 1,000 years ago, however long ago it was. So,
sent over to the directory. The priest had to talk to me.
Right, so science and religion
can't. I asked the question that stumped them all. You can believe in religion, and you can believe in Christianity and God. But where that ends is at the Big Bang. All right. We know science all along how the universe was developed. But my question to the priest was, okay, who created the dust?
Right. Or who created the creator? I mean, that's ultimately the question. Corky, thank you for the call. And I'm not here to propose any solution to that. Greel in Greenville, Alabama. Hey, Greel, what's up?
Hey, how are you, Tom? Nice
Good.
To talk to you today.
Thank you. And you too. What's on your mind?
My point was, he was talking to that reverend earlier about abortion and gay rights, and I look at the GOP as they don't have a platform, so they bring up these divisive issues.
Sure.
And
they've been doing it for 40 years.
My look at that is I look at that God or Jesus was pro-choice. I mean, he gives you the choice to either do what's right or sin, but he gives you that choice. And the Republicans are trying to take a woman's choice away and gay and lesbian people's choice away because they have no platform. And one more thing, if you take God and turn the D 180, you get GOP.
Okay, there you go. And if you spell it backwards, of course, you get this is the old dyslexic joke, dog. Thank you. Johnny in Golden, Colorado, listening to 760 AM. Hey, Johnny, what's up?
Hey, Tom, big fan. Talking about religiosity and state of the nation, that Pastor Hagee guy is going to give us the pleasure of coming to our state and talking to people in Wheat Ridge, just a town just north, about 10 minutes, with a big, like, a Jewish festival thing, talking about Jewish culture and how the Christians and them, the end-timing flat earth crowd, kind of in cahoots. Tell me they're not going to be talking about politics up there and stuff. It's super creepy. I wish you had time to go protest, but I don't.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. Thank you, Johnny, for that. I remember the last time I was in Israel, there was a busload of Christian evangelicals, you know, taking a tour. And I was standing there with a friend of mine who lives in Israel, who is Jewish. And, you know, what's that all about? And he says, oh, you know, they're coming over here trying to get ready for the end days when we're all going to die and they're all going to, you know, inherit the earth. It's like, you know, we'll take their tourist dollars. It's like, you know, it's kind of a cynical response. But anyhow, Bob in Mission Viejo, California. Do I have that right, Bob?
Yeah. Hey, Tom, that is correct. Mission Viejo. But, you know, I've come to believe that the Bible and all the quote sacred texts are sort of a literary litmus or a literary Rorschach test.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me what it says, I'll tell you who you are.
That's an excellent point.
And say again?
That's an excellent point.
Yeah. So what I would suggest that we do is, if you really want to vote your values, if you really want to see change in America, you have to create space for change. You know,
yeah.
The punctuated equilibrium says that once an ecosystem is filled, you don't have evolution in that ecosystem anymore.
Right.
We're not having this conversation because the dinosaurs are still around, because if they weren't, we wouldn't be.
Okay, I got
Leave
it. The intellectual and religious dinosaurs. Got it. Excellent point, Bob. Thank you. Dale in Fullerton, California. Hey, Dale, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I'd vote for Jesus if he was on the ballot.
Okay.
But he doesn't seem to be.
No, he doesn't. It's been a while.
I believe that our two candidates don't have an idea on what they really should be doing.
Yeah, certainly Romney doesn't. I think Obama's fairly clear about that in the Democratic Party. They've just had the Republican Party shoot down everything they've been trying to do. Romney, on the other hand, has literally been on both sides of virtually every issue. Ben in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Ben, what's up? We got a minute to the break.
Oh, not a problem. I just wanted to make a real quick comment about, I would totally vote for a candidate that would open up their eyes and say, look, these evangelicals and all these religious fanatics that are out there, especially that are flying jets or helicopters into their religious sermons, they can go out and go buy San Antonio's first stadium with millions and millions of dollars, and which the Christian value and belief is supposed to be, let's help the poor, let's help the hungry, let's help the needy, you know, and when the guy has a suit that's worth more than my house, I kind of have to say, this has got to stop here, and I would totally vote for a candidate that would say, no more of this tax break for these people, no more of this stuff like that, or any sort of things that says, hey, we got to have our religion into government.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm in favor of saying, you know, enough already with the tax exempt status for churches, you know, and other than monasteries. That's my one singular exception. We'll be back. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, there's an effort to make a consumer-owned health insurance co-op in Illinois. We're going to have L.A. Richardson on about that right after this.
I'm to spare your life if bloated premiums you'll pay. But if you can't afford this ransom, here is what I'll say.
If you can't afford this ransom, here is what you'll say.
Would that be health insurance?
Yo ho, yo ho, go ahead and die.
From shingles, berry, or a piano.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Elliot Richardson on the line with us. He's the president of the Small Business Advocacy Council. SBACIL.org is their website. And, Elliot, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, thank you so much for having us on. I truly appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
Thank you. Do I have this right that you guys are trying to put together a consumer-owned health insurance cooperative there in Illinois?
Yeah, we're not only trying to do it, I think we're pretty much on the 5-yard line, Tom, trying to run this thing into the end zone. So that's exactly what it is. We're trying to, through the power of critical mass and patient-centered care and innovation, bring down the cost of health insurance for small business owners and our employees by putting together a cooperative that doesn't answer to shareholders but answers to these small businesses in that cooperative.
So you're all going to collectively get together and own this thing. Are you going to administer it the way that, for example, a lot of unions and self-insured corporations do, use one of the large insurance companies to do the back office stuff, or are you going to do that yourself?
You know, the plan is to start with a TPA, so there wouldn't be an insurance company involved.
Mm-hmm.
The plan would be to start with a third-party administrator that would be able to use our expertise to run the insurance company, like a lot of self-insured plans.
Right.
Ultimately, the cooperative, as we build a network and mm-hmm. as we get more established, would essentially run the cooperative on behalf of the consumers, on behalf of the small business owners.
That's
so,
great.
Yeah, and you know, luckily there's a lot of very, very smart folks, doctors and surgeons and business people who are trying to put this together and really bring down the cost of health insurance,
right.
Along with just put everybody together to run a big cooperative.
Right. So, for example, United Healthcare, the CEO there makes more than 1,000 times what his average employee makes. They've got over 100 people who make over $1 million a year. That's pretty mind-boggling. You're just going to cut all that stuff out and say, you know, we'll just hire some guys with green eye shades and who like to read spreadsheets to men and women to handle the bookkeeping and the paperwork stuff here and run this thing not for profit.
Well, yeah, you're running non for profit, and I mean, the more disturbing thing about what you said about the United Healthcare CEOs is that, you know, there's members of the SBAC who have 10 employees whose health insurance has gone up 36.1% over the past year, and they have absolutely no reason why. So
right.
I think you start with transparency. There's also a ton of wonderful people in the medical profession, doctors and surgeons, who are tired of the health system running the way that it runs. Doctors being paid by the test as opposed to patient and really working on the patient. And certainly I think it will be important to have people running this without any profit. But on top of that, I think we have to be innovative. We have to bring wellness. We have to bring technology. We have to really focus on the root of what causes healthcare rates to rise. Because
yeah.
as long as they keep rising like this, it is going to consistently be a job killer for small businesses.
Yeah, yeah, well said. Are there other organizations around the country that are doing the same, Elliot? Are you part of a movement, or are you just a lone entrepreneur out there, or whatever the word would be?
Well, no, actually, interestingly, the funding for these cooperatives come out of the Affordable Care Act. So there was a part in Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, whatever you want to call it, which has a lot of money set aside in the form of a federal loan, Now, they're not giving you the money. They're loaning you the money to have the reserves to start these self-insured cooperatives.
Wow.
We actually have support from both Senator Durbin and Senator Kirk to put this together because, obviously, people across the state, across the political spectrum, I believe, have come to the conclusion that small businesses must have the opportunity to compete with the four large insurance companies that are raising our rates. Now, these cooperatives have been formed in states as red as Wyoming and Utah
mm-hmm.
and as blue as Massachusetts. So, this is a real opportunity to change the game.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Elliot Richardson, SBACIL.org is the website, the Small Business Advocacy Council. You're doing great work, Elliot. I wish you the very best.
Thank you so much, Tom. And again, thank you for giving us the platform to get this message out.
My pleasure.
Okay, thanks.
Keep it up. Good talking with you. Thank you. Let's see. Lisa in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Lisa, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how are you? Hey, I have to tell you, I was raised strict Catholic. And once you're raised strict Catholic, you feel that religion is an important part of your life, but you can't step foot in another church.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't raised my daughters religiously, and I do feel guilty about that. But the main reason that I don't attend anymore is I think because of my upbringing in the Catholic Church, I could never have an abortion, but I don't think that I have the right to decide for anybody else until you're faced with an unwanted pregnancy. And the thing that bothers me the most is that if, in fact, the priest of our parish tell us that a cell is alive, then I realize that a live person is alive, and I've never seen the priest advocate to the men of our parish and say, you're healthy, You need to go give one of your kidneys to those on waiting lists that will die without it. In fact, they haven't tried to push the government to dictate what a man must do with his body. I mean,
well,
a man.
Wait, hang on just a second, Lisa. I won't dispute that not only the Catholic Church, but many, many parts of virtually all of the monotheistic religions and some of the polytheistic religions are patriarchal and kind of stuck in the Stone Age in regard to some of those issues. But the Catholic Church has been, I mean, you know, nuns on the bus. The Catholic Church has for a long time in the United States and around the world been at the forefront of social justice movements, you know, working to feed people, to clothe people, to educate people. To taking care of the poor. I mean, it didn't just start with Mother Teresa. I mean, go back and look at the history of, actually one of my favorite was, St. Teresa of Avila. The middle name of one of our daughters is Teresa, named after her. She wrote, you know, the book, her book is called Interior Castle. And she was the one who was trying to reform the church in the, 1400s, I think it was. And she was persecuted for that. She was very good friends with St. John of the Cross, who was because of his supporting her and trying to, you know, take vows of poverty. He was arrested and tortured, and the circular torture where he was, you know, tied up and thrown on the floor and had to eat things off the floor and while he was being whipped by a group of monks who walked around in a circle, But I mean, that was like the beginning point of the church really starting to get into social advocacy. Lisa, thank you for the call.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I think many of you who are regular watchers or view or listeners are quite familiar with my thoughts on judicial review in the Supreme Court, and certainly what's going to be happening as a consequence of this presidential election. We have three members of the Supreme Court who are over 75, I believe, four or five who are over 70, and at least one of them has cancer. The next president is going to make some serious decisions, and in fact, the one with cancer is Ruth Bader Ginsburg. One of the most liberal people on the bench. And if she gets replaced by a Romney appointee, you're going to see a court going so hard right. It's going to be, I think, frankly, it's going to be like the court was in the 19-teens. But Adam Friedman is with us, a conservative legal commentator, author of The Naked Constitution. Adam J. Friedman, FREEDMAN.com is his website. Adam, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. First of all, the core stuff. I'm curious where we stand relative to each other on this issue. Where in the Constitution does it give the Supreme Court the right to strike down a law passed by Congress?
Well, the judicial power in the Constitution, in Article 3, extends to all cases arising under the Constitution and laws passed by Congress.
Right, but where does it say that a law can be struck down? It says that they should be the court of final appeals with regard to those. But where in the Constitution does it, you know, I'm assuming you're familiar with this history, that until 1803, the Supreme Court never struck down a law. And in the first 60 years of this country, the Supreme Court only did it twice.
Well, until 1803, Tom, it's only a few years between the ratification of the Constitution.
1879.
The first Supreme Court and then Marbury versus Madison.
That's 15 years.
Which asserted the right of judicial review. And that was Article 3 says, relatively little about the judicial power. And
right.
I think that the power of judicial review is a reasonable interpretation of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court.
Why would it be?
Cases arising under the Constitution.
This is not what Hamilton was arguing, though, in Federalist 78, 79, 80. I mean, I agree with Newt Gingrich on this. Hamilton was saying that the Supreme Court would be the least malicious of all, the least able to be effective. And, you know, they have no control over the purse. They have no control over the sword. You know, the purse is Congress's. The sword is the president's.
Yep.
They would be, you know, and Jefferson when Marbury came down, and of course Jefferson was president in 1803,
yep.
And when the Marbury case was laid down, he couldn't contest it because he won it, which put him in this really weird double bind. And because he had won, and so he wrote, this is what he wrote to Spencer Roan, who was Patrick Henry's father-in-law, or son-in-law, rather, and a good friend of his, a federal judge in Virginia, on the Virginia Supreme Court. He wrote, and I quote, "If this opinion be sound, then indeed has our Constitution become a complete felo de so." That's Latin for legally a suicide pact. "For intending to establish three departments coordinate and independent that they might check and balance one another, it is given, according to this opinion, to one of them alone the right to prescribe rules for the government of the others, and to that one, too, which is unelected by and independent of the nation. The Constitution on this hypothesis is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please." And then he goes on about how, you know, absolute power is always destructive and it always destroys people and countries and you know, goes on about this. He says, "My construction of the Constitution is very different from what you quote. It is that each department is truly independent of the others and has an equal right to decide for itself what is the meaning of the Constitution in the case it submitted to its action, and especially where it is to act ultimately and without appeal. A judiciary independent of a king or executive alone is a good thing, but independent of the will of the nation is a solecism." An old word for blunder, at least in a Republican government. Thomas Jefferson was furious about Marbury, went to his grave feeling that way, as were many, if arguably, if not most of his contemporary. Virtually all of the anti-federalists, the Democratic Republicans, were very upset with John Marshall, the grand old man of the Federalists, deciding as he did in Marbury.
Well, I think they were upset with Marshall for a lot of reasons. I mean, he was definitely a staunch Federalist. There's no question about it.
But, I mean, there was such blowback in 1803 that you didn't see another decision in the history of the Supreme Court that struck down a law until Dred Scott, until 1856.
Right. Yeah, I agree, Tom. I think that the power of the judiciary to – even assuming the judiciary has the power of judicial review – I think the burden should be heavy before the court overturns a democratically enacted law. But I do think that judicial review is a reasonable interpretation of Article 3 because Article 4 contains the Supremacy Clause. If courts can listen to cases arising under both statutes and the Constitution, there is a hierarchy of laws. The Constitution is the supreme law, and therefore somebody has to have the final say about what's constitutional, in my opinion.
Well,
in the
founders' opinion, that somebody was the people themselves. And I commend to you Larry Kramer's book for more on this topic. I mean, we'll hop off this topic now if you'd like. But
yeah,
Larry Kramer is the dean of the Stanford Law School.
Right.
He wrote a book called The People Themselves. And Jefferson, Hamilton, who was no friend of Jefferson's in many ways, and many others, argued forcefully that if Congress passed an unconstitutional law, then the people themselves should throw those bums out and get a Congress that would fix that, that would remedy that. And historically, that's what that has been what has happened. The Supreme Court has been sometimes ahead of public opinion, sometimes behind public opinion, but basically always tracked public opinion, whether it was slavery, women's rights, minority rights. I mean, you name it, abortion, whatever, you know, all these hot button issues. And I just, you know, gay marriage, for example, you've got on your list here. Gay marriage is going to be one of the issues coming before the Supreme Court for review. And Scalia just a couple of days ago said, well, gay marriage, you know, that's a no-brainer. Sodomy's been illegal. You know, gay sex has been illegal for hundreds of years. You know, obviously it's constitutional to have laws against people, you know, being who are gay, being married, or even having, you know, even gay people having sex. And I'm like, what? Where in the Constitution does it say anything about gay people?
Well, it doesn't say anything about gay people, and it doesn't address marriage at all. It's one of the I would argue it's one of the many issues that the Constitution leaves up to the states. And I would argue, for example, that the Defense of Marriage Act, which was obviously a bipartisan affair signed by President Clinton but heavily supported by Republicans, is unconstitutional under the 10th Amendment. It deprives the states of the right to define marriage, which was
– I don't disagree, but what Scalia wants to do is at the federal level – say that, or maybe I'm misinterpreting what he said, correct me if I'm wrong, that at the federal level, you can, you know, that the Defense of Marriage Act was actually constitutional, basically. I mean, Scalia's had many opportunities to knock it down. He certainly hasn't, so I'm guessing he agrees with it.
Well, he may be telegraphing what he would say if they decide to take that case. But if so, I disagree with him on that one. Again, not all originalists agree. What we agree on, and there are a lot of progressive originalists out there. What we agree on is the need to try to be faithful to the text of the Constitution.
But why? Because was this handed down by some great deity? I mean, we've got one of the most anachronistic election systems, for example. Our first-past-the-post winner-take-all election system, which is in the Constitution, was a horror. I mean, James Madison realized it after the Constitution was written, and Federalist 10 spent all of Federalist 10 saying, you know, don't form political parties because we've got a screwed up electoral system. John Stuart Mill came along in 1861, just as we were, you know, in the Civil War and figured out how to do proportional representation. You know, why should we look at this document and say, oh, well, they came up with this 235 years ago. It must be perfect.
Well, because it's a valid law, Tom. We don't take that living Constitution philosophy and apply it to any other law in the books. My view is, if you want to say you have a living Constitution, then, you know, why not say you have a living speed limit and just go as fast as you can, or a living tax code?
Well, Nevada did that.
I don't have to pay money to the IRS anymore.
Germany did that with the speed limit.
Say that.
Yeah. Okay. Adam Friedman, AdamJFriedman.com, the website, the author of The Naked Constitution. Thank you, Adam, for dropping by.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, you know, should the Supreme Court have the right to strike down laws? I don't find it in the Constitution, neither did Thomas Jefferson. He's horrified by the Marbury decision. Slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. You know what we should have played, Shano, is the Sesame Street theme song, because that's what everybody's remembering from the presidential debate, is that Mitt Romney wants to shoot Big Bird. Melanie Roussel is with us. She is the National Press Secretary for the Democratic National Committee, BarackObama.com, of course, the website. Melanie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. You've got some new Obama for America ads out. I'm curious, the Big Bird ad. First of all, tell us about this.
Well, you know, of all of the budget busting items that Mitt Romney threats that Mitt Romney could have identified, for some reason, the one thing he said he would cut in the debate was PBS.
Right.
PBS that accounts for 0.014% of the federal budget.
Right.
And so the ad is a comedic take on Mitt Romney seeing Big Bird as a threat in the midst of many other things he could have identified.
Right. Do you think that, I mean, when I'm looking at these kind of undecided voters, the word that I use from time to time for undecided voters at this point in an election cycle is either stupid people or people who are just like so busy and so, and very often because they have no choice, but just so busy that they haven't been able to pay attention. They're working three jobs. They've got two kids. They're just, mm-hmm. you know, blown out. I mean, it's either a lack of ability or a lack of interest. And I think anybody lack of interest, I'm willing to use pejorative adjectives to describe. Is it possible that Big Bird is going to play with that crowd? Or is, you know, should we be talking about the fact, you know, picking up a cue from some of the Republican attacks on Romney, particularly the McCain attacks on Romney 4 years ago, that, you know, the guy has been all over every position. He will say whatever it takes to win. He has no soul. He has, or at least no political soul. He has no internal moral compass. He has no core political beliefs. His life demonstrates that. Isn't that something that should be, you know, pointed out?
Well, that's certainly something we have pointed out. But what I'll say about the ad is, you know, Mitt Romney today said that it makes him scratch his head that we would be talking about a trivial issue. But what makes us scratch our heads is that...
Michelle? Or Melanie?
Tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. He says we would do that by getting rid of funding for PBS and Big Bird, which, again, makes up 0.014% of the federal budget.
Right.
That's not a deficit plan. It's a joke.
In other words, this is another example of Mitt Romney basically refusing to be detailed. You know, the thing that, gets me, there's no secret about this math. I don't know why anybody has to quote any agency, you know, whether it's the president in the debate or y'all in your ads or any of us. We take in, the federal government in the United States last year took in $1.9 and change trillion dollars in federal income taxes. So that's roughly $2 trillion a year. Over a 10-year period, that's $20 trillion. If you add the inheritance tax and a little bit of inflation, that's you know, $25 trillion. So we get 25. That's an easy number for people to get their heads around. Mitt Romney has said 1,000 times he wants a 20% across-the-board tax cut. 20% of 25 is 5. Mm-hmm. How can he deny that he's suggesting a $5 trillion tax cut?
Well, today he went so far as to say in the Des Moines Register editorial board meeting that he actually wouldn't cut taxes for the wealthiest Americans.
Wait a minute. That's completely different from what
he's ever said before, which is that he would give a 20% tax cut across the board for everyone,
including the top 1%.
He said in the debates, in the Republican debates, including the top 1%. He has doubled and tripled down on that. But this is not shocking. This is a candidate who has been dishonest throughout his campaign, and he was certainly dishonest throughout his debate performance. He was dishonest about the size of the tax breaks for the wealthiest because they're so big, and he has no plans to tell us how he plans to pay for them. He would rather lie about it. He was dishonest about his health care plan. He knows that his health care plan is not going to cover people with pre-existing conditions who are not already insured.
Right.
He knows that, and he was dishonest about it. He was dishonest about his Medicare plan because he knows it's going to take away the guaranteed benefits that seniors are used to having. He wasn't honest about his plan for dealing with the deficit. The only detail he gave us was that he would cut funding for PBS, which, again, is a total joke. So it's not surprising. This is a guy who has been dishonest throughout, and we're going to continue talking about that.
Sure. And good on you for that. We're talking with Melanie Roussel, the National Press Secretary with the DNC, BarackObama.com, of course, the website. Melanie, John Kerry got just horribly, savagely attacked for being a flip-flopper. And some small but measurable percentage of the electorate who voted against Kerry when they did the exit polls said that they didn't vote for him because he was a flip-flopper. And it was enough to give George Bush the victory. You know, even if it was a fraction of 1%, and my recollection is it was 2 or 3% of people who thought that was a substantial issue. Why not paint Mitt Romney with this?
Mitt Romney has called himself severely conservative. He is stuck by the most extreme positions that he struck during the Republican debates, mm-hmm. and when he was seeking out the nomination. And he swears that he is this severe conservative who believes in this very limited government that would cut PBS. These are the positions he staked out, and he should be held accountable for them.
Yes.
And the reason he should be held accountable for these extreme positions is because they are far outside the mainstream. We can't let him lie about it, though.
Yeah, I agree.
We're going to make sure he is held accountable for those positions that he's doubled and tripled down on over and over again throughout the course of this campaign.
Well said. Melanie Roussel, thank you, Melanie.
Thanks so much, Tom, for having me.
Check out the campaign at BarackObama.com. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So how do we get our Constitution back? How do we, the Supreme Court has become 9 kings and queens of America. What are you going to do about that? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Cheryl in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Cheryl, thanks
Hi,
for
Tom.
Listening to KPOJ.
This is the second time I've heard that co-op insurance guy being interviewed. And
co-op insurance.
I'm just wondering.
Elliot Richardson.
This insurance can only be purchased by small business employees. And
well, no.
It's the small business insurance pool by just like cherry picking people that are more.
Can you
healthy.
Hear me, Cheryl? It is the small businesses themselves who will own this insurance company. It is a member owned cooperative.
Right.
So what's your objection to that?
Well, it's just that they won't allow individuals to buy in.
Right. That's because it's a co-op of businesses for businesses. These are businesses that provide health insurance to their own employees. I mean, our business, it provides health insurance to all of our employees. We pay 100% of the cost of health insurance for all of our employees, all of our full-time employees, which I think is pretty much all of our employees now. And in doing that, if instead of going with one of the big insurance companies, I could be, we could become part owner in a cooperative with, 500 or 1,000 other small businesses, and not have to, be given money to an insurance company industry CEO. I'd be really happy about that.
Oh, okay, I see now. Okay.
It's like it's taking the hustlers out of the business, basically.
I see.
So okay, thank you very much, Cheryl.
Real quick thing. Christians should vote for Obama. Gay marriage and abortion are a choice, and taking away tax deductions and eliminating programs is not a choice.
Okay, got it. Thank you, Cheryl. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
Before I forget, I've tried to email and I can't, but I wanted to suggest a book about Islam that we were talking a few weeks ago, and it's called Destiny Disrupted. A History of the World Through Islamic Eyes by Tamin Ansari, written in 2009, and it gives a very basically a world events through. He's a born in American, born in Afghanistan. He lives here, out here in Portland, Oregon now.
Okay.
And he's a he's contributed to a number of textbooks on college level textbooks on what he called it the Middle World, not the Middle East, but
right.
Okay,
great. I just made a note of it, Paul. I'll look it up after we get off here. So is that what you called about?
No. I wanted to talk about the Christian evangelical movement in the United States particularly has become, and this is not new, it's been going on for about 150 years, is they have become a bullying sect of Christianity that disavows virtually every other denominational Christian denomination and the Catholic Church. My brother, my oldest brother, who's about your age, is one of these born-again evangelicals, and he doesn't even believe that Catholics are Christians.
Right.
He thinks they're kind of Christians, but not really. He doesn't think that we were raised Lutheran. My mother is still a devout practicing Lutheran. He doesn't have any respect for her. He doesn't think that that is a that she's really pursuing a faith in Jesus
Christ.
But
what's your point, Paul?
Well, they've sidled up politically to the Republican Party.
Right.
Pick up any novel by Sinclair Lewis written in the 20s, and you can see exactly where the Republican Party is today.
Yeah,
and it's the same stuff.
Yeah,
it's exactly the same.
I don't
stuff.
Disagree. The title of the novel was "It Can't Happen Here." You're absolutely right, Paul. Thank you very much. And by the way, it wasn't that novel was prescient. It was that the same kind of debates were going on back then as now. Tom in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. It's good to join you here. I'm an over-the-road trucker, so I usually listen to you through WCPT out of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just north of Indy right now. And ever since this last presidential debate, there's been something that's been kind of weighing on my mind, and it's I did watch it very, very closely, and what really struck me is the difference in the demeanor between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. And I think what Barack Obama really needs to do in the next debate is just to throw out everything that his handlers and advisors are telling him and just be his own man. Mm. And when a question is addressed to him, don't look at Mitt Romney, don't look at the audience, don't look at the moderator, but just look right into the camera and talk to the American people, not in a professorial way, but just talk to them, sort of like an FDR.
This is one of the things, Tom, you know, Barack Obama has always been the college professor, and it's what you're talking about is making him behave in a way that kind of contrary to his nature. But I don't disagree. He needs to learn how to talk in bumper sticker. Thank you very much for the call. Tom Jay, in Chicago, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Tom.
Hi, Tom. I agree with you that corporations are not people and money is not speech. But at the same time, if we didn't have judicial review, we wouldn't have legalized abortion throughout the country.
Not
and
true.
We would have all kinds of...
Not true.
About.
Not true. What you're asserting, first of all, for our listeners who don't know what we're talking about, judicial review is the doctrine that the Supreme Court can strike down laws passed by Congress and signed by the president. And it is nowhere in the Constitution. It's a doctrine that the Supreme Court itself came up with in 1803 in a decision called Marbury versus Madison, and then amplified the second time they used it in 1856 in a decision called Dred Scott, which kicked off the Civil War, and which ironically said, people are property. Dred Scott affirmed slavery, and the mirror image of that, in my opinion, is the 2010 decision of the Supreme Court's Citizens United, which says the property is people. But my point is that you're saying, you know, and this is the argument that so often is made, is that, you know, well, if the Supreme Court did not have judicial review, you'd still have segregated schools because you wouldn't have Brown v. Board. You would still have back alley abortions because you wouldn't have Roe v. Wade. And you would still have, fill in the blank, right? I would submit to you that, in fact, if anything, the Supreme Court has retarded our progress as a nation by using judicial review. And a great example is Plessy versus Ferguson. I mean, you know, this was a case in which the Supreme Court in 1898, as I recall, created separate but equal. I mean, they institutionalized apartheid in the United States. And Brown v. Board was simply the Supreme Court reversing itself. It wasn't the Supreme Court reversing legislation. And this is, you know, number one. And number two is if the will of the people was, hey, enough of the back alley abortions already, let's make them, you know, legal, rare, and safe, then Congress would catch up with that. You know, if the will of the people was that women should vote, well, the Supreme Court didn't give women the vote. They should have a long time ago, but they didn't. I mean, if they're going to use judicial review. But my point is that we the people are the ones who should be deciding what is and what isn't constitutional and using that as the basis to elect people to the House of Representatives and the Senate who will then pass or repeal laws that are constitutional or repeal the unconstitutional laws.
But those are state laws that you're talking about that govern abortion and.
I'm talking about at every level, whether it's a law, whether it's a municipal law or whether it's a federal law. It is not, in my opinion, it is not the purview of the Supreme Court to decide what it is and is not constitutional. What the Supreme Court should be doing is what they did in every but two cases from 1789, when this republic started, until 1856, you know, with one single exception. What they were literally deciding, you know, okay, this chicken was eaten, this farmer's chicken was eaten by that farmer's dog. How much does that farmer owe for that chicken? I mean, that's, you know, the Supreme Court was the final court of appeals. You have to have a final court of appeals where you just can't go any farther. That's
right.
How they're designed. Read the Constitution. It's right there.
Right. And the Supreme Court still does that.
But no, they don't.
It also,
that's the problem. They've
no, they resolve.
Yeah, occasionally. Okay, occasionally the final court of appeals, but they have become basically, and all the time, you know, we're the kings of America. We're going to decide what is and isn't constitutional, and that's not their role. We didn't elect. We didn't design a nation, or our founders did not design a nation to have nine unelected kings and queens.
But you know, the Supreme Court. It's often said to be, or the guarding the Constitution is protecting the minority against the majority.
That is not the role of the Supreme Court. The role of the Supreme Court is to be the final arbiter of cases at law before them, to decide what the law says and what the law says, and then and make decisions based on that in individual cases that are rendered before them.
Well,
you know,
now,
what you're suggesting is that the Congress and the president and we the people are not smart enough to figure out what is and isn't constitutional, and I think we are.
Well, Congress just passed the National Defense Authorization Act, and the president signed it, and it provides for indefinite detention.
Right, and you and I think that's unconstitutional, and the Supreme Court doesn't.
Well, at least one federal judge thought it was.
Right, but if the Supreme Court thought it was unconstitutional, I guarantee you it would be on their docket right now. They're not going to strike that down. And, so, you know, we can't turn to the court and say we need these nine people in black robes to save us from ourselves. We have to take that responsibility ourselves. Tom, thank
you
for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, just think about it really seriously for a minute. Do you really think that the best way to run this nation is to have nine unelected people making the final decision on everything? I don't think that's a good idea. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. Free-don.org. Ellen Rentner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's going on?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, Tom, it's really interesting. The great state of Ohio, where I am from, the Republican Secretary of State went to the court and said they wanted to enforce the law that says that they can stop early voting, essentially absentee voting, 3 days before the election.
Right.
Lower court said no. Appellate court said no. Where are they going? They went to the Supreme Court today.
So they're just trying to run the clock out on this to keep people from early voting, and that's because African Americans in Ohio are 30 some odd times more likely to use the early voting than white people are.
This is
all racial voters, race-based voter suppression.
Or for reasons that you may have to work at a hospital or something like that, and you can't get to the polls that day.
Right. Well, and I think that's probably why African Americans are using the early voting, which happens on a weekend. You know, the 3 days it gives you Sunday, is because so many people in lower economic, socioeconomic categories in these large cities are, you know, they're working 5 days a week, sometimes 6 days a week, sometimes 7 days.
That's right. Exactly. Okay, so fiscal cliff issues came up. There was a very interesting debate that happened today between right and left, not members of Congress, but these are sort of economists. And the Democratic members of various committees Nancy Pelosi and others wrote to the Republican committee chairs and says, we're ready to work. Mm-hmm. Where are you? You're having a hearing tomorrow on what went on in Benghazi, but right. How come you're not willing to have committees when we are facing huge fiscal issues in this country? We're here. We're ready to work. Where are you?
Well, the Republicans haven't been ready to work since that night that they got together, the night that President Obama was inaugurated. When you and I were together that night. I mean, thank you for inviting me to the inauguration. And while we were at the party over here at, you know, watching Joe Biden and Barack and Michelle Obama dance at Union Station, there were 17 members of Congress meeting at the caucus room restaurant in a private room, swearing a blood oath to each other. I mean, Jim DeMint and John Kyle and Paul Ryan, that they would obstruct the president and keep the economy bad.
Well, it's interesting because today, Senator Schumer, third-ranking Democrat in the Senate, he said that tax reform should include higher tax rates. He said that to raise enough money to reduce tax rates and cut the deficit, you would need to slash deductions and credits on a far greater scale than happened in 1986. He said cutting the top rate and reducing the deficit does not necessarily protect the middle class. We have to increase the top rate to 39.6%. Meanwhile, what did Governor Romney say today? He said he'd repeal the estate tax.
Right.
Completely repeal it.
Which is at zero, was it this year or last year?
Well, it's 5.212 million are exempt. So if, you know, in other words, if you're Warren Buffett, you're not going to have any estate tax to pay?
Right. That sounds a little odd.
A little odd. I mean, it's
staggering. Even Warren Buffett, by the way, thinks that's a little odd.
Yes, he certainly does. And by the way, today on Air Force One, as the president was on his way to Columbus, Ohio, the Obama campaign said that Ohio is Obama country. Now, I happen to know this because my friend was a chair of the, well, he wasn't chair, he was executive director of the Ohio Democratic Party. Since even before the last election, they have put in a lot of ground, get out the vote stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're saying is we will win this because of our ground operation in Ohio. Now, Romney is, of course, saying, well, I'm doing well in the polls, et cetera. But the whole issue, and this is why they want to go to the Supreme Court, is how to not get people to the polls on Election Day.
How to keep people from the polls, Democratic voters from the polls.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that is their whole whatever.
Yeah, voter suppression is clearly an important part of their campaign.
Now, as you know, we have a vice presidential debate on Thursday evening. And there is, by the way, almost a 28-year gap between Vice President Biden and Paul Ryan. It's the largest gap that has ever been in apparently history of these kind of debates. Mm. And it's expected that because of that, Medicare is going to be one of the huge issues. And really the generational difference in Medicare.
Yeah, and Biden is probably eligible for Medicare or close to it.
How
he's
old is,
be in his 60s.
Let's see. No, he's almost 70.
He's almost 70.
Yeah,
so he's of Medicare age.
That's right. He's definitely Medicare age. You get it at 65, and of course, people of your and my generation would get our full Social Security at 66.
Yikes.
I know. Then the other issue is about what the Obama campaign is saying. They're wondering which Paul Ryan is going to show up for the campaign. Is this or for the debate? Is this going to be the inclusive Paul Ryan or the Paul Ryan who is now trying to divide the nation according to how he sees it? Hmm. And that's what the Obama campaign is saying.
Or the Ayn Rand Paul Ryan.
Right. You know, yeah. That's for sure. Let me just quickly go through one other thing, which it looks like that America Crossroads and Crossroads GPS, those are both Karl Rove, super PACs. They are putting a lot of money on Senate races. They're not putting a lot of money into House races. Only apparently $2 million has gone into House races.
I think they think they've got the House and they're going to keep it.
That's right. But they're not so sure about the Senate.
Right.
You have people like Cousin Josh in the great state of Ohio.
Right, right. Yeah, you were born and raised in Ohio, actually. What's your sense of how that's going to play out?
I actually think Ohio is going to go for Obama. And I think my cousin is not going to become the next U.S. senator. I think Sherrod Brown will.
From your lips to God's ears, Ellen.
That's right.
So what? Any other?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Juicy
the other juicy tidbit is very interesting. So the Sesame Street folks say that they object to President Obama's Big Bird ad. As you know, they show all these criminals, and they say Governor Romney cares more about Big Bird than going after criminals. He's
right.
Not mentioned that. And the Sesame Street Children's Workshop has objected to the ad.
So they're offended?
They're offended. The Obama administration is actually taking it under consideration.
Oh, my. Oh, my. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
And check out free-don.org. Don Siegelman.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And by the way, don't forget, we're going to be giving away a free copy of the Tom Hartman Reader today, autographed by the author. Who would that be? Oops. Yeah. The Tom Hartman Reader. It should be a lot of fun. Should be interesting. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, among others. And Eddie in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hey, Eddie, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Well, thanks for having me, Tom. The reason for my call is, as a disabled Army combat veteran, I find it disturbing that Mr. Romney wants to continue to pimp out the military. His coming out party for Paul Ryan at the USS Missouri, and then his quote-unquote major foreign policy speech yesterday at Virginia Military Institute, in his attempt to tug at the the base strings of his party. I just wanted to get your take on it because it makes no sense at all. The militarization of our foreign policy is obviously alienating us and isolating us around the world, and I just wanted to get your take on it. As you know, like I said, as a veteran, I just find it deplorable.
Historically, here's my take on it. Historically, those politicians who have been veterans, whether it was George McGovern, who flew some, I think it was 36 bombing missions over, you know, during World War II, over Italy and France, and actually, you know, made an emergency landing that everybody thought he was going to die in, and saved his plane and his crew, and everybody got shot down. Whether it was Dwight D. Eisenhower, you know, the Supreme Allied Commander of U.S. forces in Europe during World War II, led the invasion of Europe basically by American forces. Those guys who have been there, done that, seen it, John Kerry, you know, wounded three times in Vietnam, those guys who have been through the hell of war tend not to be the war hawks. You know, there's the occasional exception. John McCain is probably the most notable one, although I would submit to you that John McCain really never saw the consequences of war. He flew an airplane and dropped bombs on people, which is sort of like running a video game. And then he was a prisoner of war for a bunch of years. And so I don't think it's quite, parallel. So my take on it is that Mitt Romney has really no understanding of the military, no understanding of the horrors of war, no understanding of how this stuff happens and what it's like to be in a war zone, or, you know, and therefore he can speak so cavalierly about war. I mean, war is a horrible, god-awful thing.
I agree.
It is organized insanity. And you get, you know, politicians who understand that. I think it's one of the reasons why we need to have a draft. I mean, it's been, you know, we have so many politicians who have never served in the military. The military has become, you know, a narrower and narrower slice. It's less than 1% of the American population that is doing, you know, so much for this country, and yet, you know, taken so for granted by so many people.
I agree with that. My father was a martial arts instructor, and one of the things he did before we decided to take martial arts, my brother and I, was to go through a class with him, and he did that brief amount of pain when you would get into a lock or a hold to give you the awareness of what you are using against your opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And so we always walked into a situation not wanting to put someone in a lock or a hold, but trying to diminish the situation before we had to go that far, because we knew how it felt.
Right. The goal,
so,
you know,
your words are just, on a global scale, your words are so appropriate.
Yeah, and so when Mitt Romney
there do not understand.
When Mitt Romney, I mean, with regard to his avoiding military service in Vietnam, he chose instead to take an exemption for religious purposes and spend, you know, a year or two in France with his butler and his maid and his chef, and you know, make sure that that France was safe from wine and cigarettes. But, you know, I say that semi-sarcastically, but I think that, you know, if that was a genuine heartfelt thing, that, you know, exemptions from the draft from the military for religious reasons, I don't strongly object to. But with regard to his sons, he's got five sons, you know, who are all of military age and certainly have been for well over a decade. And he was asked, are any of your sons going to serve their country in the military? And he said, all my sons are serving their country by working on my campaign. I mean, that was actually his answer. And
that's unfortunate. And you scratch at the surface of something deeper when you mention his religious exemption from military service.
Yeah.
We have yet to talk about Mr. Romney's Reverend Wright.
Who is?
According to CNN, there was a pastor who mentioned to Ryan that Mr. Romney wasn't Christian, and that was just something that scratched the surface on a CNN crawl. And I just find it interesting that in this election cycle, religion is off the table versus 2008, when we needed to pry and all these theories about black liberation theology. I'm African American, by the way, so I feel comfortable talking about this.
Sure.
You know, black liberation theology and Reverend Wright, yet we have Mr. Romney, who apparently his religion is off the table.
Right. Right. Well, and you and I both know that that whole Reverend Wright thing had nothing to do with religion. It had to do with race. And
had everything to do with character. If you don't look like me, then I need reasons to be afraid of you.
Right.
Yet if you kind of tend to look like the majority, then, yeah, you're okay.
Yeah. I think that, you know, tragically that's the case. Eddie, thank you for a very thoughtful comment. I appreciate the call. And thank you for having me. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks for watching the program there on Dish Network. Dwayne in Sonoma, California. Hey, Dwayne, what's on your mind?
Well, the Constitution. I would suggest that the Constitution, the Supreme Court, works exactly as intended by the people who were in convention there at the Constitutional Convention in secret. And it served, first of all, to maintain slavery for half a century. It was intended to do that. The prior Articles of Confederation, slavery would have come apart very quickly. Now, or if the Supreme Court had been properly designed, the Bill of Rights, when it came into effect in 1808, would have freed the slaves.
Not true. Your premise that the Supreme Court maintained slavery, the Supreme by use of judicial review. If what you're talking about is judicial review, the power of the Supreme Court to strike down laws, or in some cases actually create laws, create doctrine, like, you know, money is speech. The Supreme Court only used that twice, from 1789, from 1789 when the Constitution was ratified, until 1856. Once in Marbury versus Madison in 1803, and once in Dred Scott in 1856. That was it. So they did not use judicial review to support slavery.
Well, they didn't enforce the Bill of Rights for black people, which would have ended slavery. I mean, if you can hardly. If they'd enforced the Bill of Rights, people would have had a right of free speech. They would have been a right to be armed. And it's hard to tell a man that you've extended his slavery to the life of his children if in fact, the slavery was a debt for having been transported over here.
No, I don't disagree with any of that. You're absolutely right. I mean, it was, you know, in retrospect, like a criminal conspiracy, but it wasn't just the Supreme Court. It was the Supreme Court. It was Congress. It was the presidency, the executive branch. And frankly, you know, the people of the United States, we all have that blood on our hands. And it's something that we need to be making good on. Well, you know, we need to be helping people recover from the multi-generational, from the you know, five century Holocaust that was slavery, that continues to be slavery in many parts of the world, frankly.
Well, we need to modify the Supreme Court by constitutional amendment.
Well, I don't see where that has anything to do with judicial review. I don't think that that's a good argument for there being judicial review, if that's what you're trying to say.
I would give them a different assignment, enforcing the Bill of Rights, and I don't see where the Supreme Court has done anything other than harm with their decision on the draft. I don't see where that's constitutional, and their decision on
Corporate
corporations.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, Dwayne. I'm with you. Thank you very much for the call. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And one of our callers today is going to get a free signed copy of the Tom Hartman Reader. We'll be right back.
Wait a minute, I am just about to be brilliant.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, 20 minutes past the hour. Oh, yes, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, get informed. Joe in Baltimore, Maryland. Hey, Joe, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'm a new listener, and I feel like I found a pot of gold.
Okay, good. Well, thank you.
I wanted to offer something about the debate. I know there's a lot of conversation out there, but, you know, technically speaking, debate does have rules. And what Governor Romney demonstrated, a high schooler would have been thrown out of a debate.
That's true.
He used an illegal debating technique called spreading, which means that you use all of your time and you speak very rapidly, you tell a lot of lies, and you change your position from what you've been, you know, stating previously, and in this case, all through his campaign.
Yeah, I call it the throw spaghetti on the wall technique. You take four or five things that are demonstrably false and throw them out, and then your opponent has time to intelligently answer one of them, and the other three or four that don't get answered, people, low information voters, assume that they must be factual. They must be truthful.
Well, and that's right. Or that your opponent would become frustrated. You know, Romney was trying to anger the president.
Certainly.
Okay, now, there are ways to get around this. One of them is obviously know your audience. And sadly, I don't think the campaign anticipated this kind of behavior from Romney. But the other one is to remain professional and to speak your piece in your platform, which I think he did. But did not get any credit for it.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't think that there was a winner or a loser. I don't think that you can win a campaign by lying or by filibustering, basically, or by doing the throw the spaghetti against the wall strategy. Joe, thank you. And I don't believe that you can lose a debate by simply stating your truths. John in West Los Angeles. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just think all of your listeners and viewers should be aware of Republican Representative Paul Brown from Georgia. He recently was videotaped giving a speech. This is on September 27th at a Sportsman's Lodge or Sportsman's Banquet, which actually was at Liberty Baptist Church in Hartwell, Georgia. And what he said was that the evolution, embryology, the Big Bang Theory, basically all the science that he was ever taught are lies
right
straight from the pit
satanic
of hell.
Satanic lies, yes.
This guy is not only a physician, he sits on the House Science, Space, and Technology Committee.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He's running unopposed.
I know. It's like James Inhofe. You know, if the Republicans take the Senate, James Inhofe, who thinks that global warming is a hoax, is going to become the chairman of the committee that oversees global warming. It is bizarre. John, excellent point. Thank you for making it. Roger in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Hey, Roger, what's up?
I wanted to speak with not only you, but have your listeners and your viewers paint a picture of an NPR newsroom or public broadcasting newsroom as opposed to Big Bird. Put the picture of what the GOP has wanted since the Reagan administration. They almost got the opportunity during the Bush administration when a man by the name of Tomlinson came in. But unfortunately, like a man who just buys a new suit and leaves the price tag on, that's what happened with him. They found out he had an agenda. So they can't compromise NPR or PBS. So what they're trying to do is kill it like they've done with Acorn.
Right.
They don't give a hoot about Big Bird or any of the other programs. They just want that news dissemination.
Yeah, it's about taking out a vehicle for news. I don't disagree with you. Candy in Bloomington, Minnesota. Candy, thanks for listening. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for all you're doing. I wanted to talk about, as others have talked about, the debate and the main media response to it, and I've just been stunned that they've all really said that, you know, made a big deal about Romney winning when, as your other viewers have pointed out, and you, that he lied in order to get his point across. And so I've written a letter to CBS, and I plan to do it to the others, saying, you know, challenging them on this and why they haven't pointed out all of the lies and the facts that he took such opposite positions from ones he's taken for. Are we so accustomed to this man jumping around in his positions that we don't even notice it anymore?
I think so. I think that that's what's happening. And thank you, Candy, for your point. One of the points that I was going to make to Melanie Roussel, the National Press Secretary for the DNC, and I say these things to these folks in the hopes that they will kind of take them back and kick them up the food chain and or do something with them themselves, is that I was at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference. You know, I've done that every year for, 6 or 7 years. I mean, for a long, long time. And 4 years ago, during the primaries, CPAC was, you know, held during before the primaries, and Mitt Romney was running at that time against John McCain. He lost to John McCain. But at CPAC, they had a guy walking around in a flipper outfit, right, as a dolphin. And they were giving away these giant, you know, foam rubber flippers that you could clapping with. And the whole point was Romney's a flip flopper. And I think that frankly, I think the Obama campaign should reprise that. Ken in Littleton, Colorado. We have a minute to the break. Ken, what's up?
I just wanted to comment on Romney walking into that debate with his Big Bang pants on. And pinning Jim Lehrer in his chair, I think that was more the purpose of telling him what he was going to do to PBS and Big Bird.
You think he made the Big Bird comment to intimidate Jim Lehrer?
That's right.
I think he intimidated Jim Lehrer right off the bat. I mean, he started out with the first word, and then he said, I'm going to have the last word in the first segment. And Jim Lehrer was like, no, you're not. And he was like, yes, I am. And then he just kept right on talking.
Yeah, he was telling him he was taking control.
Right. And that was before the Big Bird comment. So, I think he set out to intimidate the president and Jim Lehrer. And I would love to know what those guys said to each other before they started. You know, when they shook hands and they were both, you know, speaking off mic to each other. I'm just so, Ken, thank you very much for the call. I'm so curious whether it was just pleasantries, hey, how are you? Or whether there was some kind of embedded NLP-like message that Romney conveyed that might have seemed innocuous but wasn't. Just curious, you know.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Having watched the master, Richard Bandler, do that, where he literally incapacitated somebody, had them falling off their chair and rolling on the floor from 40 feet away. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very incruentulously ugly, the good. Obama for America. President Obama's campaign has released a new ad poking fun at Mitt Romney's debate comments last week that he would cut funding to PBS and Big Bird. Take a listen.
Bernie Madoff, Ken Lay, Dennis Kozlowski, criminals, gluttons of greed, and the evil genius who towered over them. One man has the guts to speak his name.
Big Bird. Big Bird. Big Bird.
It's me, Big Bird.
Big, yellow, a menace to our economy. Mitt Romney knows it's not Wall Street you have to worry about. It's Sesame Street.
I'm going to stop the subsidy to PBS.
Mitt Romney, taking on our enemies no matter where they nest.
Fine. No matter where they nest. Finally, a politician in America is ready and willing to take on one of the most important and pressing issues of our time. The greed and corruption that has taken over Sesame Street. Watch out, Cookie Monster. Mitt's coming for you next. Unless your cookies are from 7-Eleven, in which case you're probably safe. The bad. Corrections Corporation of America. If you want to understand why prison privatization is so bad, look no farther than Lake Erie Correctional Facility in Ohio, America's first privately owned state prison. According to a recent audit of the facility, the prison has no emergency fire plan. The prison cells are rarely cleaned. Prisoners are forced to sleep on the floor, medical treatment is a joke, and the quality of food served to the prisoners is subpar at best. Basically, CCA is denying these prisoners, who are still human beings, basic human rights. This is because with private prison companies like CCA, the only thing that matters is profit and the bottom line. The fact that prisoners have to live in squalor doesn't mean a thing. And the very, very ugly Charlie Fuqua. Fuqua is a Republican running for the Arkansas State Legislature, and let's just start by saying he has some very disturbing views. First, Fuqua believes that all Muslims should be expelled from the United States and thinks this sentiment is shared by most Americans. But that's nothing compared to his view on unruly children. In his book released earlier this year, Fuqua writes that, quote, a child who disrespects his parents must be permanently removed from society in a way that gives an example to all other children of the importance of respect for parents. The death penalty is not something to be taken lightly. End of quote. Yeah, you heard that right. The death penalty for unruly children. I think this comment really speaks for itself, and that is very, very ugly.
That's mind-bogglingly ugly.
Oh, my goodness. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi. I have an opinion about the debate, which I think the facts seem to point to, but I think a lot of people would think is way out. And that is that, do you remember before the election, when before the debate, when Karl Rove and the other Republicans, they were all like, they were already like celebrating having won it?
Yeah.
Gloating about it, you know, they were saying,
sure.
They were saying, you know, like, you know, after the debate, it's, you know, we're going to have it in the bag.
Chris
know.
Christie came on national television and said that, yeah.
Yeah. And, well, it you know, when the debate happened, Lehrer seemed to be cheating for Romney. and the president seemed to be taking a dive.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and, I don't think that, you know, Mark, thank you for the call. I don't think that coming up with excuses for the president's, frankly, poor performance, or for that matter, condemning Mitt Romney for telling lies, which he did, is going to change the reality of what happened, which is that a lot of disinformation got out there that a lot of Americans believed and that the press didn't do a particularly good job of calling Romney out on. And so anyway, Carla, you know, it's just what is what it is. We need to move on. Carla in Pueblo, Colorado. Hey, Carla, what's up?
Hi, friend.
Hi.
According to the Supreme Court, don't you think that we should change the makeup of it and have three Republicans, three Democrats, and three independent green justice?
That would be an interesting interesting mix. The only way to have that happen would be to have a green president or independent president, which is probably not going to happen in our lifetime. But very interesting idea. Carla, thank you for calling and sharing that. There was actually a proposal that Franklin Roosevelt made in 1936 that I thought was a pretty good one. He said that any Supreme Court justice over 70, that the aggregate of all of them who are over 70, they get one vote. They're called Supreme Court justices emeritus. And so basically, as soon as somebody hits 70, it's an automatic retirement, except they're not really retired. So if you have one who's 70, he has one vote. If there's five who are 70, collectively, they have one vote. And that would have opened up three or four spaces on the court in 36 for Franklin Roosevelt to add. I think he was going to take it up to 13 members of the Supreme Court because the court kept knocking down his New Deal stuff. And he ultimately backed down on that. And in fact, some historians suggest that he could have won that argument, but he never did. Randy in Smock, Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. My question is, why is money considered speech? To me, speech is audio communication measured in decibels,
mm-hmm.
period.
Money is considered
is
speech because
communication measured in currency. The First Amendment distinctly mentions freedom of speech, not speech slash money.
Right. Money is considered speech because the Supreme Court has decided that it is speech. They started with a decision called Buckley versus Vallejo. Arguably goes, you can take it back to the 19th century, the early doctrines of it. But basically it's the court's way. I mean, the court is the ultimate insider institution, and it's the court's way of saying, you know, the insiders in this country, the really, really rich, they have more say than the rest of the people in this country. And it's just, you know, you've heard me say many times, we have two criminal justice systems in this country, one for the very rich and powerful and the other for everybody else. And the same thing with the tax system. We got one tax system for people who work for a living, and we've got another one for the Mitt Romneys and Paris Hiltons of the world. And similarly, you know, the Supreme Court. So anyhow, Caroline in Maywood, New Jersey. Hey, Caroline, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just have two quick comments, actually. I'm very disturbed with our politicians in Washington. The majority of them are men, and they're continuously trying to make decisions on my body, the female body. I think they should allow us to have our own say over our own bodies. Leave us alone.
Yeah.
And the other comment is, I really hope that all of the people come out, and I mean all the gay, lesbian, transgendered, and bi people come out on this election and vote the way they should be voting for a Barack Obama, because obviously with Romney and Ryan, we would be tortured and put to death and whatever else there is.
Right.
By the way, Mr. Rogers, a decorated SEAL, by the way, Navy SEAL.
Mr. Rogers was, really?
Decorated Navy SEAL, saved I don't know how many countless people, was tattooed from his wrists up to his arms, and that is why he always wore long sleeves.
Are you serious? This has got to be one of those.
Positively, absolutely. Also, Captain Kangaroo, believe it or not.
Bob Keeshan.
Yes, I did not remember his real name, but yes.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. Shane just checked this, and he said it's an urban legend. So, you know.
No way. I got this. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
I just got this.
Sorry to debunk it, but.
Oh, too bad.
You know, yeah. Anyway, Caroline, thanks a lot for the call. Evan in Peoria, Illinois. Hey, Evan, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Good.
I know despair is not an option, but I want to have you talk me down here, hopefully.
Okay.
Now, you're talking about Ohio, how most likely we'll go for Obama, and but aren't
well,
these,
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think that, you know, look at the incredible efforts. I mean, right down to the point where they're paying people to call into this program and say, I'm a Green. Do you really want to win Ohio by 10 points? I mean, shouldn't I be able to vote for the Green Party in Ohio? I mean, I'm a progressive, and I've, and, you know, it was clearly in retrospect, particularly since the polls were dead even now or at that point, you know, clearly one of these Republican callers.
My main question is, with these voting machines, they're being, they're from a Republican-leaning company, and
right.
What's to stop them from programming in, you know, flipping Democrat to Republican? And
I am of the opinion that they've been doing that since 2000, and I think that there's a fair amount of evidence
that
they have been. And you know, go to blackboxvoting. I think it's .org is Bev Harris's site, and or bradblog.com, Brad Friedman. I mean, they have been all over this forever, right from the get-go. And I am very, very distrustful of these. I agree with Senator Bernie Sanders, that we need to go back to paper ballots like the rest of the world uses.
Evan, thank you very much for the call.
Yeah. You know, Ireland just put up all their voting machines for sale for scrap metal. I mean, consider that. Catherine in Wheatland, Wyoming, or West Virginia, excuse me. Hey, Catherine.
I'm in Wyoming.
Oh, Wyoming. Okay. Oh, yeah.
I'm listening on 760 from Denver on my smartphone.
Yep.
I am very annoyed about this whole deal with Romney and the cigarette companies. It just seems to me that we have here a terrible hypocrite who knew from his childhood that cigarette smoking was very, very bad.
And yet he made a lot of money at Bain pushing cigarettes on poor people in Russia after the Soviet Union fell.
Not just people in Russia, Americans too.
Hmm.
You know, he figured out how to, the best way to market cigarettes for different stores in this country. You
wow.
know, I just find it incredible that this person is running for president of the United States and nobody's even talking about this.
Yeah. Catherine, thank you very much. You just talked about it. We just talked about it. And we'll continue to talk about it. And it's in our newscast at the top of every hour. 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, exposing the con in conservative. Back with your calls, my thoughts, the news of the day. Right after this brief opportunity for you to support your local station.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
No, I mean that seriously. You hear an advertiser, there's a local advertiser that is, you know, supporting the station. Call them up and thank them for advertising on the station.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Alan in Gary, Indiana, listening to WCPT. Hey, Gary, Alan, excuse me, what's up?
Okay, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to follow up on this military service also. Mm-hmm. In 1963, because I remember very, very well, Bill Clinton went to Canada during the Vietnam War, and you didn't mention anything about
him. He didn't go
to
Canada. He went to...
Yes, he did.
He went to England.
Canada. Pardon me?
He went to England. He got a scholarship.
He went to Canada first, Tom, because I remember it distinctly, because I was in the same bases when I served in the Vietnam era. I just wanted to make that comment, but he still was a good president.
Yeah. I mean, you can believe that. The knock that I've always heard on Bill Clinton was that he got out of the Vietnam War by having his Rhodes Scholarship and going to the U.K., by going to basically at a college deferment, the same as Dick Cheney.
Okay.
But,
well,
you know, I guarantee you, if he had gone to Canada to hide out from you know, extradition from the police, he never would have been president of the United States.
I think check the records, Tom.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know you do that. So
yeah.
Anyway,
I'm quite confident of this.
Okay.
So, Alan, thanks for the call. But was your larger point something about military experience in the presidency?
The larger point is, do we require military service to be a requirement for presidency?
Yeah, I don't think we should.
Really. Well, maybe so, but they do have experts. But what about President Obama? I mean, he wasn't in the military, but
That's
he does
correct.
Have experts around him.
Yeah, and he was, you know, I mean, he was born after the draft ended, so there was no requirement for him to go into the military. Alan, thank you for the call. As I said, I think some of our best presidents, our most peaceful presidents, have been people who saw the horrors of war. Jack Kennedy, you know, his P. Tebow was cut in half in, you know, PT-109 in the Pacific. And, you know, they were stranded on this island and just incredible heroism. His older brother, Joe, who was going to be the guy who was going to run for president, was killed during World War II. And Jack Kennedy understood what war was. And that's why during the Cuban Missile Crisis, he took that so very, very seriously. So I think that there's something good to be said about people having some understanding of what war is before they're in a position to make war. On the other hand, we've had some very, very good presidents who never were in war. Franklin Roosevelt, for example. So I wouldn't throw the proverbial baby out with the bathwater. Jeremy in Stanwood, Washington. Hey, Jeremy, what's up?
Not much. Thank you, Tom. I just had an idea for someone who maybe had a little more artistic talent than me to draw a picture maybe of Romney evicting Sesame Street.
Ha! Yes.
You know, like a nice little...
Yes, there you go. That's a great idea. Yeah. Jeremy, thanks for calling and sharing that. Crystal in Keene, Texas. Hey, Crystal, what's up?
Hey, with the conversation being along the lines of religion, of course, religion should not be anywhere in our Congress buildings or our presidential buildings or anywhere else. It's just not the way to go. The whole premise of America is based off of being able to be free from religious rule.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So why are we continuing to have this conversation when it comes to our presidential and our congressional election?
Because America is one of the most religious Western countries in the world, if not the most religious Western country in the world. Religion
is true. We are religious, but we are of many, many, many different types of religious. Of course, I'm more for spirituality than I am for the religious empire, but, you know, sirrah, sirrah.
Yeah, yeah. I think that that's basically the answer, though, is that it's going, if a lot of people care about something, it's going to become an issue in an election. Thanks, Crystal, for the call. Sonia in L.A., in Los Angeles. Hey, Sonia, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say, in agreement with the Buddhists are the only religion. They're not the only religion. Jehovah's Witnesses also have a conscious objective,
mm-hmm.
and we need to take church away from state. Jesus Christ talked about that.
Well, the Quakers,
he said he
too.
Was separate from state. He
yeah.
said you cannot have both. They're separate.
Right.
And
yeah.
I love your show. I just wanted to say that because there is one religion that does say no. No religion
right.
is a part of politics.
Yeah.
Thank you,
okay.
Tom.
Thank you,
continue
Sonia.
Doing what you're doing. We love you.
I'll do my best. Thank you for your kind words. And by the way, let me toss the Quakers in there. The Quakers are pacifists, and God bless them for it. Sadie in Glenville, Georgia. Hey, Sadie, what's up?
Hi. I wanted to comment on that. We just listened to him on mute after his first two answers because we could see it was going to be lies. Mm. And when we watched him, it was on mute, and what we saw was a rabid Romney or a robot on speed.
Mm-hmm.
And when we listened to Obama, we saw a reasonable man who had policies and objectives. Mm-hmm. And it was just, I saw a different debate than most mm-hmm. people saw. And I think they should put a picture of that Rush Limbaugh scene when he went – he melted down and did his hopping and jumping.
Oh, at the CPAC.
Mitt Romney.
Yeah.
That would be something to watch. No sound, just watch the two
yeah.
little monkeys.
Yeah, that must have been very interesting, watching Mitt Romney without the sound. I'll have to go back and look at it.
It was much better with him muted.
I can imagine.
And Obama won.
Okay. Sadie, you, and speaking
thank
of
you,
one,
Tom.
You won a book. We're going to send you a copy of the Tom Hartman Reader, an autographed copy. So I'm going to put you on hold here, Sadie. Thank you for the call. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV in Glenville, Georgia there. She's on line 10, by the way. You can tell Danielle. And we will send you a copy of the Tom Hartman Reader brought to you by Stamps.com. And thank you very much for thinking about that. So anyway, I'm with you, and I think it's going to be a really interesting – this is a really interesting campaign. Well, we'll have the latest in the campaign trail, including a preview of Thursday night's vice presidential debate coming. But most importantly, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. And it's not even electoral politics. I mean, it's important to register to vote. It's important to vote. But what's more important is to participate, is to, you know, go to pdamerica.org and sign up. Go to movetoamend.org and sign up. Get involved. Get out there. Occupy something. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.